Welcome to IAW 2014 on this fine spring equinox. So comparing and contrasting anti-apartheid activism in South Africa and Palestine is a potentially vast topic. You know, we could have an entire week's conference devoted to that. So I want to focus mostly on the myth and reality of anti-apartheid activism in Canada as it relates to South Africa before and after Mandela's release from prison in 1990. Basically, one of the modest goals I have for today is to suggest that the details of this history, not just the overarching forest, but the concrete awareness of the individual trees, offers lessons and insights that have contemporary relevance to the struggle for justice and liberation in Israel-Palestine. So before getting into those details, I should probably say a few words about my own history and biases with respect to these issues and what led me to this particular theme for today. So I've been kind of an interested observer in the Israel-Palestine conflict since 1987. And when the crackdown against the new Intifada broke out in late 2000, a few of us, as Bassam mentioned, started up the Canada-Palestine Support Network here. In the fall of 2002, I had the privilege of participating in what was called the Olive Harvest Campaign in the West Bank, living with ordinary farmers and accompanying them to their olive orchards to help with the harvest, not just to bear witness, but to work the field alongside these families, and also to try to mitigate human rights abuses by means of essentially a single deterrent, and that was the relative privilege of an international passport and the threat of bad press. So that experience gave me some new insights into the meaning of settler. What is a settler? Basically, as armed fascistic thugs from the nearby illegal colony of Tapua engaged in daily pogroms against the farmers and the villagers and had the audacity to shoot at indigenous families and tell them without shame or irony in their very clear Brooklyn accents that they had no right to be there. So that brings us to today's topic. And whether or not it's legally accurate or politically astute to describe the state of Israel as an apartheid state is a matter of unquestionable significance to all sides in this discussion. It's a question that has dominated Israeli apartheid week since its inception, precisely because of the backlash against IAW on campuses, in the media, and in legislatures, including Manitoba. Similarly, in supporting the Palestinian call-out for a comprehensive boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, or BDS, it also behooves us to explore the successes and failures of similar campaigns in the past. But most of the discussion, in my opinion, on the merits or demerits of extending this analogy to Israel-Palestine have kind of operated at a high level of generality, with proponents of it often knowing very little about the South African experience, and detractors often knowing very little about the Palestinian experience, and neither knowing much, really, about how anti-apartheid activism and boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns in the 70s and the 80s played out, really, in Canada and elsewhere. One of the triggers that inspired me to want to revisit this issue in more depth was reading this atrociously uninformed article 3 years ago in the National Post. This was a piece by a sessional instructor in history at the University of Manitoba named Catherine Chatterley that purported to offer a history of the Israeli apartheid week and offer insights into the history and nature of anti-Semitism and the alleged misuse of the term apartheid when applied to Israel-Palestine. One of the things that I wanted to focus on specifically was the statement that she made objecting to any analogy to apartheid whatsoever. Quote, "The difference, of course, is that South African apartheid actually was a vicious white supremacist ideology that had no supporters on university campuses," end quote. There's two things that are striking about this to me. First, that it dismisses the analogy by assuming that Zionism and Jewish nationalism, as expressed through its allegiance to the State of Israel, have not become, at their core, a vicious ethno-religious and indeed supremacist ideology. And second, that it purports to make an historical claim about the anti-apartheid struggle in Canada, that apartheid South Africa had no supporters on university campuses. And both of these are empirical questions, but I take them both to be demonstrably false. The first claim has been documented amply by Palestinian and Israeli scholars over the years, from Edward Said and Nir Masala, Omar Barghouti, to Israel Shahak, Tanya Reinhardt, and journalists like Gideon Levy. I wanted to focus on Chatterley's second claim, by looking back at the anti-apartheid era in Canada. So as somebody who was heavily involved in that in Winnipeg at the U of M in Students Against Apartheid there, also across the city in the Manitoba Coalition of Organizations Against Apartheid. But arguably, it becomes more timely and even more urgent in the political sense in the wake of Mandela's death this past December and the nauseating and opportunist myth-making that immediately followed in the media. So politicians and business leaders and celebrities of all stripes lined up with their own personal reflections, mostly centered around the notion that Mulroney was a champion of the global anti-apartheid struggle. And most opportunist of all was Conrad Black, perhaps, who praised Mandela as a, quote, greater leader of an idealistic movement, a tremendous moral leader. This from the man, Conrad Black, whose own corporation, Massey Ferguson, violated the spirit, if not the letter, of the mandatory UN arms embargo of 19, and was also a committed supporter of Buthelezi, the leader of the Inkatha Freedom Party that murdered African National Congress supporters with the South African state's backing. So the praise 25 years later from Black for Mandela and his idealistic movement demonstrates probably the worst and most stunning degree of cynicism and hypocrisy. And you'd be hard-pressed to find a better example of that, of a more committed Canadian defender of the apartheid regime than Conrad Black during the 80s. Canada's right-wing rush to associate itself with both Mandela's name and the historic anti-apartheid struggle is one of the most striking and preposterous. Harper paid tribute to Mandela in the House of Commons. I won't quote all of his nauseating statements. And his official delegation to South Africa for the funeral of Mandela was the symbolic culmination of that effort. It had no less than 5 prime ministers of Canada in attendance, plus the former governor general, the NDP leader, 3 Canadian premiers, the Assembly of First Nations national chief, Sean Atleo, Erwin Kotler, and the delegation afforded further opportunities for myth-making. Leaving aside the sheer audacity of Harper himself, and his comments and his attendance at Mandela's funeral, given that he was a founding member of an active pro-apartheid organization, the Northern Foundation, not just with circumstantial ties to, but actually infused with white supremacist groups in the 80s, I wanted to explore a little bit Canada's actual record on South African apartheid. Most of the media has focused on the leading role of Mulroney between 84 and 93, so I wanted to maybe confine the discussion to some of the points of that narrative. There's several claims. One, that Mulroney was an almost defiant and lone voice who used international forums such as the Commonwealth and the UN to advocate on behalf of a non-racial South Africa. That Mulroney's administration led the world in imposing sanctions. That Canada was a friend to Mandela and the African National Congress. And the proof of this friendship is the fact that Mandela and the ANC never failed to acknowledge and praise the contributions of Mulroney and Canada in general. I'll give some examples of these things and in the process maybe show how off-base Chatterley's assessment of the anti-apartheid movement in Canada was. Ian MacDonald's article in the Montreal Gazette in December talked about this. Like, Mulroney immediately took up the cause of Mandela and South Africa's oppressed black majority upon election in 1984. And according to MacDonald, one of the first indications of this was the Commonwealth Summit in Nassau in the Bahamas in October 85, at which Mulroney is supposed to have strongly supported a unanimous resolution calling on the Afrikaner minority to dismantle apartheid. But media coverage of the day paints a bit more of a nuanced perspective on that. In the Winnipeg Free Press, for example, an article pointed out that Mulroney, quote, stood out as a voice of moderation yesterday on how to deal with South Africa's regime, while Third World Commonwealth leaders called for tough economic sanctions to end apartheid, end quote. So contrary to the contemporary coverage today, lauding Mulroney's vanguard role and defiant role within the Commonwealth, the coverage of the time was quite clear that the real leaders in advancing the cause of anti-apartheid at the Commonwealth were the Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi and the Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, who called for mandatory and comprehensive sanctions against South Africa. Mulroney's opposition was clearly rhetorical. And the media coverage of the time made that. And Western elites went en masse to South Africa for Mandela's funeral to pay their respects, not to the anti-apartheid hero that had inspired social justice activists between the 60s and the 80s, but to honor perhaps what Mandela had become, both symbolically and practically. After his release from prison in 1990, and particularly after the ANC's own subsequent call for an end to sanctions in 1993 and the historic election of 94, Mandela himself gradually shifted from a visionary resistance leader to a more pragmatic statesman. And it was in that latter capacity that he solidified his sort of eternal rehabilitation in the eyes of Western elites that had once labeled him a communist and a terrorist. But this conciliatory approach and the decision to increasingly court Western politicians and corporations didn't always sit well with the ANC's rank and file, nor with international solidarity activists, especially those for whom more revolutionary and anti-capitalist politics was just as important as human rights advocacy. There were deep divisions within the ANC itself, evident long before 1994, over how to deal with neoliberalism and the threat of neocolonialism in a post-apartheid South Africa. Veteran ANC activist Ronnie Kasriels commented on this transition of the ANC as their sort of Faustian moment when they took an IMF loan on the eve of their first democratic election, along with all of the structural adjustment implications that that entailed. According to Kasriels, that was when the ANC lost its soul to corporate power. But regardless of what one's interpretation, it's clear that after inheriting one of the most unequal societies on the continent, Mandela and the ANC were faced with this unenviable task of trying to alleviate widespread poverty and landlessness for the black majority amidst a severely depressed economy. Different choices could have been made during those pivotal years. But Canadian politicians such as Mulroney and Harper, in lavishing praise on Mandela and attending his funeral, were no doubt honoring the choices that were made, or simply attempting to capitalize on a massively popular legacy and movement that they in fact opposed and demonized at the time. I'd bookend this discussion by noting that there was another member of Harper's official delegation to Mandela's funeral, and that was Catherine Chatterley herself, the woman that I was mentioning earlier, the sessional lecturer who had earlier demonstrated her complete ignorance of the Canadian anti-apartheid movement in this country and used that depiction as a weapon against Israeli Apartheid Week. I think it's important to think about those kinds of statements, like Chatterley's statement that there was no support for South African apartheid on university campuses, side by side with the actions of people like Jeff Shaw and Wikach. My experience in the movement was a testament to the opposite of this. So, pro-South African speakers, including then Ambassador to Canada Glenn Babb and Pik Botha himself, they were regular voices on campuses. And in the media across the country, justifying apartheid and apologizing for repression and even blaming the victims of massacres for their own deaths, much the same way we hear from apologists for Israeli repression, control, dispossession, and state terrorism today. We can open it up to discussion.